of the unusual things that we have in common is that it's possible to make a joke out of both of our names. Well, Gordon Brown, I ask you, that's not difficult, is it? Doesn't test your imagination. And the number of times I've had my leg pulled, not so much now, thankfully, now that another gentleman of that name is out of the spotlight, I don't get my leg pulled quite so much. But over the years, it has been. As far as my wife's concerned, her name is Faith, of course, and she is of small stature. And there have been occasions when people have turned to me and say, "Oh, you of little faith." So there you are, you see. They're not great jokes, but people who have a sense of humor tend to pull my leg. And I always seem to be on the receiving end. My wife gets off scot-free. Not fair, not fair. Anyway, that's my strange way of introducing this saying that we're all accustomed to, that is part of the English language these days, an everyday saying, "Ye of little faith." Where does that come from? Well, it doesn't take a genius to guess that it probably comes from the Bible. I'm sure you know that the King James Bible was responsible to a large extent for introducing a lot of phrases, terminology, words into the English language, which have subsequently become embedded and retained, and people don't always realize that they're quoting the Bible in their language, in their words. And the same is true of that particular saying, "Ye of little faith." It actually comes from Jesus himself. He said it. However, although that may be well known, what is perhaps less well known is that in the first gospel, the book of Matthew, he actually said it 5 times to his followers. 5 times! So it wasn't something he just sort of threw out on one occasion and then forgot about it. It's obviously something that was on his mind. It was a kind of message that he felt it necessary to repeat and keep on saying until the point got home. On the other hand, those he said it to were his followers. Whereas there were other people who weren't his followers, but who asked for his help, and they were both Gentiles, and he commended their faith. He didn't say, "You know, you of little faith." He commended their faith. And so isn't this a bit strange that Jesus' own disciples seemed to be so dodgy in their faith that he had to say, "Ye of little faith," no less than 5 times, as far as we know, may have been more than that. Whereas there are a couple of Gentiles, and there may be more, who he was able to commend for their faith. That's not quite the right way it should be, should it? So how did that happen? What was it that the two Gentiles got right, and what was it that the disciples didn't quite seem to get hold of or understand? I'd like to have a look into that this afternoon, and it's possible there may be a few pointers, a few things for us to work on and learn for ourselves. So let's briefly touch on the verses concerned in Matthew, and Matthew is where we'll be spending most of our time this afternoon. And I just want to briefly quote the 5 examples so you can see where they are, and we'll come back to them and have a closer look at them as we go along, starting in Matthew chapter 6. And this afternoon I'm going to be reading from the New King James Version, the Revised Authorized, but the other ones are not really that substantially different as far as these texts are concerned. So starting with Matthew 6, and I'm just going to hit the actual verse itself in Matthew 6 and verse 30. This is, of course, right in the middle of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, and he's talking about worrying about serving 2 masters, getting caught up in everyday worries. And in verse 30, he says, "If God so clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and thrown into the oven," and we have examples on either side of us of how God clothes the flowers and the grass of the field, "will he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith?" Example number 1. Example number 2, chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 26. This is a very different situation where Jesus is crossing the Sea of Galilee in a ship. You probably know, and we'll come back to it. But I just want you to see and read the words yourself for the time being. Chapter 8 and verse 26. "The disciples came to him and awoke, saying, 'Lord, save us, we are perishing.' But he said to them, 'Why are you fearful, O ye of little faith?'" then keep going. I will come back to these and we'll have a closer look at them in a moment. Let's keep going. Chapter 14. Chapter 14. And then just stopping in to verse 31. Here's another example on the sea. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, and the him he was speaking to was just one disciple this time, it was Peter, and he said to him, O ye of little faith. So Peter got it in the neck, so to speak, directly, personally, ye of little faith. And then, carrying on to chapter 16 and verse 8, a different situation again this time, and we'll look at it again in a moment. When Jesus perceived it, he said to them, ye of little faith, and so on. And we'll come back to see what was involved in a moment. And finally, the reading we had a few moments ago in chapter 17 and verse 20. So Jesus said to them, because of your unbelief, or in the NIV it says, because of your little faith. And so you could argue that that should be included amongst the little faith verses as number 5. Now let's contrast that with the two examples I mentioned who were commended. And we'll take a little look at those, starting in chapter 8. Chapter 8, I'm sure we'll remember the example. We might as well read through this and see what is actually said, starting in verse 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof. Just speak a word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to this one, go, and he goes, to another, come, and he comes, to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled. Some translations say he was astonished or amazed. Anyway, this centurion achieved something with Jesus that not many people have done. He astonished him. He marveled and said to those who followed, assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. So how is it that the centurion got it very right, but the disciples seem to be a long way short? Well, the answer awaits us. Let's continue reading in Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15. Different situation this time, starting in verse 21. Verse 21. Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed. But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, Send her away, for she cries out after us. But he answered and said, I wasn't sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Then she came and worshipped him, saying, Lord, help me. But he answered and said, It's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. And she said, True, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table. And then Jesus answered, verse 28, and said to her, O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed from that very hour. So there we are. We've seen those 5 examples where Jesus used that phrase or words to that effect on 5 occasions to his followers, his disciples, but to Gentiles he was able to commend for their faith. So I'm going to do a little bit of analysis to try and understand what it was that where the disciples were falling down, where they were falling short, other particular themes we can learn from, other lessons that we can pick up on. The 5 examples I'd like to cluster together into 3. Cluster 2 of them together as a pair, another 2 together as a pair, and 1 on its own. And the first 2 I'd like to cluster together as a pair, where they have something in common, is starting in Matthew chapter 6. So let's go back to Matthew 6 again, where we started,
and read it through a little bit more thoroughly and see if there is a theme that we can pick up on that led Jesus perhaps to say, ye of little faith. Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6, and let's begin breaking into the text at verse 25. He said, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on.
Now, as we read, watch out for this word worry, and just count the number of times you see it along with me.
Okay, we've read it once. Look at the birds of the air. Verse 26. For they neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more value than they? Which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature? Verse 28. So why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed, not clothed like one of those. Now, if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For after all these things the Gentiles seek, for your Father in heaven knows you need these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble.
So did you pick up on that word worry or worrying? Did you count up how many times you saw it?
Depending on how you count, I think it's either 5 or 6 times that he mentioned it. So I would like to suggest that that seems to be the problem.
And he is advocating and encouraging again and again and again, don't worry. Do not have undue concern. Do not be preoccupied with the minutiae of everyday life. Don't let that distract you. Don't get het up and worried and anxious about it. And it also seems to be suggesting that worry and faith are opposites. That if you worry, then your faith is pretty small. There isn't a lot of faith there. Whereas if you have faith, you aren't going to suffer a lot from worry. That seems to be the suggestion here. Now, what about the companion passage?
Chapter 16. Chapter 16. Starting at verse 5. Chapter 16 and verse 5. They'd crossed over the sea. And in verse 5, when his disciples had come to the other side, they'd forgotten to take bread. I'm so glad to see that the disciples forget to do things, because I do. We all probably forget to do things from time to time. But they'd forgotten something basic. They'd forgotten to take bread. If you read other accounts, it wasn't that they didn't have any bread, just that they didn't have enough. Then Jesus said to them, knowing that they were worried about it, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And they reasoned amongst themselves, saying, it's because we've taken no bread. But when Jesus perceived it, he said to them, O you of little faith, why do you reason among yourselves because you brought no bread? Don't you yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000, how many baskets you took up? Or the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up? Don't you understand? I wasn't speaking to you concerning bread in a physical sense, but that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Then, verse 12, they got the point.
They should have understood. I mean, 5,000 people is rather a lot. How many stadiums in London could accommodate 5,000 people? Not many. And if you were to be in a stadium that can accommodate 5,000, I suggest to you that you are looking at an awful lot of people. And yet Jesus fed, the Bible tells us, 5,000 with a handful of loaves and fishes. Now, if he did that, surely the disciples would realize that they don't need to worry if they've forgotten a bit of bread on the boat. And yet they were falling into the very trap and betraying the same habit that he had mentioned to them in chapter 6. They were worrying about what they're going to eat, and have we got enough bread, and I haven't been to Tesco's yet for extra milk. And, you know, they were worrying about that. And he was trying to remind them and say, well, you haven't quite got the point yet, mates. I was talking to you about that just a few chapters back, and perhaps you've forgotten what I said, ye of little faith. So I suggest that's one category. And category number one of those two sections is talking about mainly everyday life. And our tendency as human beings to get a bit worried about the problems, the difficulties that we come across every day. The second category is one that we can look at separately in Matthew chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8, compare those two sections and see if there is a particular theme coming out of there. Matthew chapter 8, starting at verse 18. Matthew chapter 8 and verse 18. Now when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side. Then a certain scribe came and said to him, Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said, Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests. Son of man has nowhere to lay his head. And so on. And then we drop down to verse 23. When he got into a boat, his disciples followed him. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves. But he was asleep. Now, if you happen to read any historical description of the Sea of Galilee, that is still a possibility today. It's a very deep sea. It's way below sea level. And the mountains are high up on either side, such that sudden tempests can blow up and suck in huge winds and cause great waves to arise very suddenly, almost without notice, on that sea, even today. And so this is a geographical feature which no doubt was well known. However, the boat was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. Verse 25, his disciples came to him and woke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are perishing. But he said to them, Why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Then he arose, rebuked the winds and sea, and there was great calm. So I'd like to suggest that in this situation, they were facing a sudden danger. A sudden, unexpected danger just happened like that, out of the blue. And they were fearful. They were worried, not just worried, they were afraid, sore afraid, very nervous. And you see a similar situation affecting Peter over in chapter 14. We've read this on a previous occasion, but does no harm just to remember it. This was the occasion where Jesus was walking on the water in chapter 14. Verse 27, Jesus spoke to them, saying, Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. But Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So he said, Come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. How can you see that the wind is boisterous? Well, I'd like to suggest that it's not the wind that you see, it's the waves. And I raised this subject during the feast with Jeff Soule, who has been there not that long ago, and said, is it normal that there are huge waves? Has it ever been known that Galilee does have huge waves? And he said, yes, they can have quite huge gargantuan waves from time to time on the Sea of Galilee. And so even as a seasoned fisherman, when Peter was out there on the water, some of these waves could have been pretty tall. And having seen that, that would automatically have instilled that fear that he felt, the automatic fear that we face when we see the danger and we know how real that is and we feel we've lost control and we don't know what to do next. So he was afraid. He was in a dangerous situation, a life-threatening situation in both cases. And yet in both cases, again, Jesus said, Why were you afraid, you of little faith? And so we still want to know how to react here. What's the situation? What can we learn from them? Well, I've isolated those two slightly different categories. One, the everyday category, the everyday situation. The other one, hopefully not an everyday situation, where a sudden danger occurs and you don't know how to react. You feel that you're not in control.
They're both different situations, but
I suggest that there is perhaps a common factor, or at least one common factor in both situations. And it's a factor that's common to us as humans. The information that we have and that we operate on from day to day, from moment to moment, is information that comes primarily through our eyes, the things we see. I'm not telling you something you don't know. We're accustomed to that. Our brains are attuned to that. We rely on information, what we see, as well as what we hear. And we are very much conditioned to that as human beings. We focus on things we can see, the physical world around us, what it's telling us, what is happening going on around us. We are influenced by outward appearance. That is the state of the human being. That is our normal mind, our normal way of operating as human beings. That's normal. It's ingrained into us. We have the five senses for a reason, and they are there to help us. But where does faith come into this? What is the relationship between faith and seeing? There isn't one. Faith and seeing are opposites. Seeing is not believing. Faith is not sight. And yet you and I rely on our sight for our decisions, to inform us, to guide us. So where does faith come into the picture? The thing is that we need to engage with faith more often than we engage with what we see. Turn to Hebrews 11, just as a reminder. Hebrews 11, chapter 1, well-known verses. Hebrews 11, and verse 1. Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Things not seen. And to support that, go back to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Starting at verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4, starting at verse 16. Paul contrasts the inner life with the outer life. And notice what he says in verse 16. Therefore we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While, notice verse 18, we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. That seems strange and unnatural to us as human beings. But look what he's saying. We do not look at the things which are seen, because they're only temporary, but the things that are not seen, which are eternal. And then in chapter 5, verse 7, he goes on to say, we walk by faith, not by sight. And yet as human beings, we are conditioned to, and we normally would, walk by sight. And so we have to begin perhaps to learn to walk more by faith, and not just by sight alone. I'm sure the name of Ruth Edwards is one which most of us will remember. She's a very faithful member from the Bristol Church who sadly has suffered from cancer for a number of years and is still struggling against it. I have a day by day which she wrote on the 10th of October. It's called Aye, Sir. Some things are so much easier said than done, but nonetheless, we need to aim for them. So think who's saying this. Think of her background. Think of the lessons she has learned. She knows what she's talking about. Which eye we use is one of them. But not the right eye or the left eye, but rather the physical eye or the spiritual one. Because we are physical beings, it's hard not to be swayed by what we see and are aware of physically. Those physical things are all too obvious and can cause us physical or emotional pain, if not both. However, we mustn't ignore the spiritual aspect. God cares about us and all aspects of our lives, 1 Peter 5, verse 7. He's involved and wants to be our main support, strength, and helper.
The Bible is full of his love for us, his promises and examples of both being manifested in people's lives. Hebrews 11 lists some, but admits that there are too many to include them all. Having read and absorbed such knowledge and examples, we need to trust our spiritual eye, to trust what we know in spite of what we physically see and feel. It's hard at times, very hard, and she should know. But still we need to follow God's instruction to fear not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today, quoting from Exodus chapter 14, the words of Moses. And she closes by remembering an old-fashioned hymn. Do you remember this chorus? I learned it in my childhood. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. So let's learn to look using your spiritual eye. So let's take this principle about believing rather than seeing, the physical rather than the spiritual, and let's apply it to these two categories. The first category, you remember, was everyday situations and the fact that we tend to get distracted by what we see. Okay, let's have a look at a favorite verse of mine, if you don't mind. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Here we have an example of down-to-earth, homespun, everyday wisdom. Near the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 11, and verse 4, reading from the New King James Version. Very simple and succinct, as they tend to be. Chapter 11, verse 4, he who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. So in other words, in basic, normal, everyday, homespun wisdom, if you allow yourself to be put off by physical appearances, you'll never do anything. This takes me back 35 years or more to a time when I was young and single, would you believe? And I remember an occasion being at the feast somewhere in England. I think it was the south of England. I can't remember the year or the location. Forgive me, my memory is bad. But I do remember that at that time we had a small church group in Israel, in Jerusalem. There were students and there were people working there, and a large number, if not all of them, actually came over to us, to England, for the feast. And amongst them there was this young girl, very keen Israeli girl, and she was always quoting the Bible to us. And I think a number of us were organizing, as we often do, a walk during the feast. We're going to do this walk, you know, just a social opportunity tomorrow. And she said, oh, but in England, you know, it's always raining. I don't want to go out and get soaked. So I said, Ecclesiastes 11, verse 4. She said, what's that? I said, he who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. If you're worried about the climate, mate, you won't do anything. She said, oh, okay, I'll come. So she came, and her friends did too, because we knew this recipe from years ago. If you can get a girl to join in the activity, the men will come along as well. Just remember that. So the men came along as well, and we had a lovely day, wonderful day out. And there was the lesson. Don't worry about physical appearances. And it's not just the weather, it's all sorts of things. But my point is this. If basic wisdom can tell us not to be put off by appearances in our normal life, what does spiritual wisdom tell us to do along the same lines? I could quote a lot of verses, and so could you. But let's go to Philippians. And this time we're going to perhaps a higher form of wisdom in Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. Starting in verse 4. Verse 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing, which of course supports what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6. But in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God.
So if you've got worries or something that's bothering you, you've got the answer.
Let your requests be made known to God by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving. And what happens?
The peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, don't expect to understand it,
will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus.
So there we have something practical that we can do if we are bothered in some way, if we find our faith is not all that it might be, something that we can do.
And last week, you remember, Barry in his sermon focused very much on prayer and the role of faith in prayer. So if we have worries or concerns, we bring them to God in prayer.
But do we really, really believe that that's the answer and that God is going to look after things? Do we really experience that peace? Well, it isn't that long ago since we sang our second hymn this afternoon, Great is Thy Faithfulness. And you will remember that in the chorus it says, All I have needed, thy hand has provided. And as we sing, we can all internally stop and think, yes, that's true. Generally speaking, as I trace my life, generally speaking, yes, all I have needed, thy hand has provided. But can we reduce that to an everyday level? An everyday level, and say, I know that all I have needed, thy hand hath provided. Because we ought to, if we really sing and mean those words. All I have needed. You don't need me to remind you how Psalm 23 begins in verse 1. I'm not going to read it. We know it very well.
And so, that's just a brief foray into applying that situation of physical rather than spiritual, seeing, not believing, to the first category of ye of little faith. And what about the second category, the sudden crisis, the danger that suddenly overwhelms us? Well, I don't want to be too harsh on the reaction here, because quite honestly, fear is a normal, natural reaction. It's, in a sense, built into us for good reason, so that we can flee, we can get out of trouble, we can engage our body's system to do something about it and not just stand there frozen. Psalm 107, for example, gives an idea of what it's like when fear sets in a crisis, and it so happens that this is also an example on the sea. Psalm 107, verse 23. Talks about those who go down to the sea in ships. And that's no doubt where John Masefield got the idea. Those who go down to the sea in ships, who do business on great waters, they see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. For he commands and raises the stormy wind, which lifts up the waves of the sea. They mount up to the heavens. They go down again to the depths. I suspect that few of us have ever actually been on a sea that has been as high as a ship, or higher. It can be quite fearful. And what happens? Their soul melts because of trouble. They reel to and fro and stagger like a drunk man, and are at their wits' end. Then they cry out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brings them out of their distresses. He calms the storm so that its waves are still. So, in a sense, fear is legitimate. Fear is normal. But Jesus does say, fear not, because he is our refuge and strength. Let's look at a story of a man in the Old Testament who did not fear, who was surrounded by danger and yet had another solution in mind. And he's in 2 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 31. 2 Chronicles chapter 31. I'd like to see how he reacted. Let's start at verse 1. Sorry, 32. Did I say 31? 2 Chronicles 32. After these deeds of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and entered Judah. He camped against the fortified cities, thinking to win them over to himself. And when Hezekiah, king of Judah, saw that Sennacherib had come and that his purpose was to make war against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his leaders and commanders to stop the water from the springs which were outside the city, and they helped him. Thus many people gathered together who stopped all the springs and the brook that ran through the land, saying, "Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water?" And he strengthened himself, built up the wall that was broken, raised it up to the towers, built another wall outside. He repaired the millow in the city of David and made weapons and shields in abundance. So he did his part. He made some natural precautions that were wise precautions to resist an invasion. Then, however, what he did next is interesting. Verse 6. He set military captains over the people, gathered them together to him in the open square of the city gate, and gave them encouragement, saying, "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid nor dismayed before the king of Assyria, nor before all the multitude that is with him. For there are more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and fight our battles." And the people were strengthened by the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. You see, Hezekiah wasn't focusing on what you could see with your eyes. He wasn't put off. He wasn't fearful. He said to the people, "Don't look at that. God is on our side. He is with us to help us and to fight our battles." He had that spiritual vision. Not only that, I'd like to suggest that there are two kinds of reality. Now we're getting into the real abstract, the real philosophy. Two kinds of reality. There is the temporary physical reality that surrounds us in the world we can see, touch, measure, and so on. And there is the ultimate reality of the spirit world, which we cannot see. In between, you might say, if you want a third category, there are things that are real and that we can detect, but we can't see them with our eyes or touch them. Things like ultraviolet light, for example, can't see, and yet it's there. There are radio broadcasts going through the waves all the time, but we, with our ears, we cannot hear them. We need a special machine in order to tune in and hear the radio. Those things are invisible, and we can't hear them. But they're real. They exist. And so I'd like to suggest that the world we're familiar with, all around us, these four walls, the streets, the city, and so on, the economy, the government, the world we live in, that's one reality. That's the reality we live in. We have no choice but to live in it for the time being. But the real reality, the ultimate reality, the bigger reality is the spirit world, the reality of God himself out there. And that's the reality we need to focus on and think about a bit more. It's not physical appearances immediately, it's the true reality. It is real. It is not unreal, it's not illusory, it's not imaginary. God is real too. In fact, he's far more real than anything in this temporary physical world. And faith is simply recognizing that true reality. Recognizing true reality. So what does that reality mean for us, and what form does it take? We heard Ruth mention a few moments ago Hebrews 11, so let's just turn to the end of Hebrews 11 for a few moments. Hebrews 11, the last verse or so. Hebrews 11, verse 39. And it gives a whole list of people, a whole catalogue of people of faith who did wonderful things. And it concludes by saying in verse 39, "All of these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise." Now, they'd received a good testimony.
Jesus would not have said to them, "Ye of little faith." He would have said, "Good was your faith, strong was your faith." They had a good testimony through their faith. But they did not receive the promise. Verse 40, God has provided something better for us, that they should not be perfect apart from us. We are another chapter in the story. What is it that's better that God has provided for us in this area of faith? Chapter 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and run with endurance or patience the race set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. The subject, the author, the center, the focus, the finisher, the completer of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross and is sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So there is something for us to help us in our faith. That is the focus of our faith. And that should have been helpful to the disciples, because they were walking around living with Jesus every day. So they had that faith. They were weak in faith. What was the problem then? Why didn't they see that reality? What was the problem? Well, you see, there was another problem. I'm not saying this is comprehensive, but the Bible tells us there was another problem. Mark chapter 6. Mark chapter 6 and verse 49. Mark chapter 6 and verse 49. Here is Mark's account of Jesus walking on the water. Verse 49. When they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost and cried out. For they all saw him and were troubled, and immediately he talked with them and said, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." The identical words you find in Matthew. Then he went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased, and they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled. For they had not understood about the loaves, because their heart was hardened. Their heart was hardened. And I suggest that is one reason why they had only little faith. I mean, they had every advantage. They walked, they ate, they breathed with Jesus. They walked with him every day. He was there. But their heart was hardened. Another word might be familiarity. I'm sure familiarity isn't the only reason, but that's one we can work with. So let's say it was down to familiarity. Perhaps they were so accustomed to walking with Jesus. There's nothing special about him. Yeah, he's the master. He's the one we follow. But somehow they hadn't quite realized who they were with, who he was, really. They hadn't quite got it. So how could this be overcome? And so we come to the last of the five examples that I quoted and which we read earlier on in Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17, starting at verse 14. Verse 14. When they had come to the multitude, a man came to him kneeling down, saying, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic and suffers severely, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. So I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." Then Jesus answered and said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and he came out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why couldn't we cast him out?" So Jesus said, "Because of your unbelief or your little faith. For assuredly, I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." Wow. That would be faith, wouldn't it? Now, not many of us are in the business of moving mountains. We don't have literal mountains. Not that many mountains around us here in London anyway. But we do have metaphorical mountains to move in our everyday lives sometimes.
Sometimes we get stuck between a rock and a hard place. We don't know which way to go. Sometimes we face all kinds of problems and we don't know which way to go. And it seems as though we've got a metaphorical mountain to move. And Jesus said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will be able to move mountains. Nothing will be impossible to you. No obstacle will be too great. And he repeated that pretty much in chapter 21. Chapter 21, verse 18. A different example, but a similar principle. Chapter 21, verse 18. Now in the morning, as he returned to the city, he was hungry. Seeing a fig tree by the road, he came to it, found nothing on it but leaves, and said, let no fruit grow on you ever again. And immediately the fig tree withered away. Now when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how did the fig tree wither away so soon? And Jesus said to them, assuredly, I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but also if you say to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, it will be done. And all things, whatever you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. So he was encouraging them to develop their faith and saying that really nothing need be impossible. I wonder if you remember a song, a little ditty that was going around a few years ago. And the chorus goes like this. God will make a way where there seems to be no way. He works in ways we cannot see. He will make a way for me. Quite a pleasant little song, a song of faith that has been encouraging to many people. God will make a way where there seems to be no way to our human eyes. He works in ways we cannot see. He will make a way for me. Wonder how you feel about those words. Sentimental mush? Wishful thinking? Or we've just heard it all before. Familiarity. So let's reread the passage in Matthew 17. Only this time, I'd like to read it in the Message version. The Message version, Matthew 17. Now, yes, this is a paraphrase, but sometimes these paraphrases have a habit of just using a turn of phrase that we can identify with a little better. Matthew 17, Message translation. Jesus said, what a generation. No sense of God. No focus to your lives. How many times do I have to go over these things? How much longer do I have to put up with this? Bring the boy here. He ordered the afflicting demon out, and it was gone. From that moment on, the boy was well. When the disciples got Jesus to themselves, they asked, why couldn't we throw it out? Because you're not yet taking God seriously, Jesus said. Interesting. Because you're not yet taking God seriously. And he was saying that to the disciples who had been with him for years, who knew the Bible, or much of it. But you're not yet taking God seriously. That seemed to be a bit of a problem. And I wonder if that might be helpful to us and to anyone who has a similar situation, especially where faith is weak or we're struggling with something. Maybe it's something we ought to think about because you're not taking God seriously. Jesus said the simple truth is that if you had a mere kernel of faith, a poppy seed, you would say to this mountain, move, and it would move, and there's nothing you wouldn't be able to tackle. Well, that's quite a challenge. That is quite a challenge. How can we take God seriously? Is there anything that could help us in this way? Well, one place to look at, perhaps. It's a big subject. I can't tackle it all in one day. But one place to think about might be Romans chapter 10 and verse 17. Romans chapter 10, verse 17. Familiar verse, and forgive me for quoting it out of context, but what it says is important. Verse 17, faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. So I suggest that taking God seriously begins by taking his word seriously. Taking it seriously. Now the reason I mention that is that if we go back and look at the two examples of the Gentiles, I think you will find that they had a different attitude. Go back to Matthew 8. Matthew 8. Did these people take Jesus seriously? Did they take him for granted? Matthew chapter 8, the centurion. Matthew chapter 8. No, I think I've got the wrong section there. It's not Matthew chapter 8. It's, 8 verse 5. Yes, Matthew 8 verse 5. And you know the story. The centurion came to him, or sent a messenger, pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. And Jesus said, I'll come and heal him. And the centurion said, Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof. Only speak a word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. I say to this one, go, and he goes, and I say to another, come, and he comes. And my servant, do this, and he does it. He was a centurion. And he was accustomed to the strength and the force of the word of command. He only had to utter a command, and it was done. There was no hesitation, no debate, no long discussion in parliament or in committee. It was done. He only had to say the word. And he knew that was the same for Jesus. He only had to say the word, and it was done. Only he realized that Jesus had infinitely more authority and power. Power that could handle the sick, the seriously ill. Just say the word. And Jesus said, I have not found so great faith in all of Israel. Just say the word. I suggest that that's not a bad example to think about. What about the second example? Matthew 15. Are these people taking God seriously? Are they taking Jesus seriously? Matthew 15, verse 21. Or let's take verse 22. A woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out, saying, have mercy on me. My daughter is severely dispossessed. But he didn't answer. He did not respond. His disciples said, send her away. Let's get rid of her. But he answered and said, no, I wasn't sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Then she came and worshipped him. This is serious. She worshipped him. And saying, Lord, help me. And you'd think that heartfelt cry for help would have got an answer. And still he said, it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. He still wasn't responding. Why not? And she said, true, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Could it be that he was testing her faith? Then he answered and said, woman, great is your faith. What was her secret? Persistence. Persistence. She didn't give up. She didn't give up. She was persistent. So on the one hand, you had the centurion who knew that Jesus just had to say the word and it was done. You had the woman who also believed that in a manner of speaking, but before she heard that word, she had to be persistent. Both had faith. Both were taking God, taking Jesus seriously. All these things we've read before, we've heard before, but just how seriously do we take them? Might be worth thinking about sometime. Is this our reality, or is this our comfortable theory? Is it real? Do we really believe the power, the authority of Jesus' words? He has the words of life. He said so. Do we believe that? Is this a reality that is close to us every day? It's a big subject. I'm sorry I'm hardly scratching the surface this afternoon, but it's worth starting. Let me share with you another day by day, And I'm not going to say who wrote this till I get to the end. It quotes from Matthew 11:28, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. You will find rest for your souls." And the message begins, "Sometimes just making it through the day can be a real challenge. There are 1,000,001 distractions ready to derail us from accomplishing our goals," as we read in Matthew 6. "By the time we fight our way through traffic and make it home, we're already exhausted. Life with Christ, however, doesn't have to be so difficult. Read what Jesus said as recorded above. He goes on to say, 'My yoke is easy and my burden is light.'" Over the years, people have looked at this verse as an illustration of Jesus taking the weight of our burdens from us and making our lives easier. But maybe there's another way to think about it. In biblical times, two oxen were yoked together to increase their power. Typically, a young ox was paired with a more experienced animal. And while the work was still hard, together they shared the burden. As they worked, each gave and received strength from their partner, and over time the younger, weaker ox grew stronger and matured. I think that to some extent we can see our relationship with Christ in the same way. He offers us his yoke, calling us to partner with him. We start off weak, stumbling, wanting to pull in the wrong direction, because we haven't got very strong faith. But as we journey with our Lord, he strengthens us, picks us back up, puts us back on the right path. It's not always easy, and there are many times when we fail him. But we know this. Our Lord has promised never to forsake us. That's part of the reality we hold fast to. He's working for and with us. That's how we are sanctified with him, by joining in this journey, allowing him by the Spirit to perfect in us what our Father longs for us to be. I hope this way of looking at that passage encourages you as we all continue our walk with God. We know that we can trust him to help us to grow in strength and spiritual maturity as we are sanctified through Jesus, our Lord and Savior. So perhaps that helps to just put it into a slightly wider context, especially when we look at Matthew, another section of Matthew, which talks about indirectly another aspect of faith. Looking to Jesus, sharing with him, walking with him. And by the way, that was written by Mr. Tkach on the 11th of October. So as we read in Hebrews 12, verse 1 and 2, Jesus is the centerpiece of our faith. He is the focus, and he is the perfecter and completer of our faith. In him, we have, or we should have, encouragement, reassurance, peace of mind, certainty, guidance, protection, deliverance, freedom, healing, on and on the list goes. We have life. And he says to every one of us today, as we've read before and are read today, very briefly, very simply, very easily, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. The time has come to take him at his word and to trust fully in him. Do that, and you will not be one of little faith.